scored the 49ers' last game-clinching touchdown by running a naked bootleg, Collinsworth's tune had changed completely. "Alex Smith is the best I've ever seen him," he said. "That drive is the best I saw. What a second half he's had." Smith's stats improved noticeably in his second season. 16 touchdown passes, 16 interceptions. Hardly spectacular, but noticeably better than during his on-again, off-again rookie season. Both he and his team went into 2007 thinking the playoffs were a realistic possibility. The once proud team, which had won 5 Super Bowls between 1981 and 1994, hadn't been in the postseason for 4 straight seasons and hadn't had a record better than 7-9 during that stretch. There was, yet again, a new coordinator for Smith to work with. Turner had been hired as the head coach in San Diego, and Jim Hostler was the new offensive coordinator. The season started well, the 49ers winning their first 2 games, including a Monday Night Football opener when Smith drove them to a late winning touchdown using his legs for a 25-yard run and his arm for a 22-yard completion to Arnez Battle that set up the winning score. This was the Smith the 49ers had drafted. But it began to go wrong for both team and quarterback in Week 3. The 49ers lost to the Steelers 31-14, bringing them back to earth. A week later, Smith was sacked in the first quarter and landed squarely on his right shoulder. The diagnosis was a separation, the way to a cure, rest. He sat and watched the 49ers lose that day and then the next 2 weeks. He came back with the 49ers at 2-4 and wasn't the same quarterback. He missed easy throws and often grabbed at his shoulder after making a throw. It was clear to many, notably players on opposing defenses, that he wasn't healthy. After a 24-0 loss in Seattle, Smith admitted that his shoulder was killing him. Seattle linebacker Julian Peterson said it was apparent that Smith was in pain and not right. Nolan didn't want to hear it. "That might mean something to me," he said when the comment was repeated to him, if Julian was a doctor. Nolan didn't want to hear Smith talking about the injury publicly. Smith has always been honest with the media. When he was asked if the shoulder was still hurting, he said it was, but that he thought he could play through it. Smith thought he was being honest. Nolan thought he was whining and said so. Smith went back to see Dr. James Andrews, arguably the world's most famous orthopedic surgeon. Andrews admitted he was surprised when he examined Smith to find the injury more serious than he had initially thought, and he told Smith, "This is much worse than I thought." Once a doctor had confirmed the extent of the injury, Smith took Nolan on publicly. In an interview with the San Jose Mercury News, Smith said that Nolan had undermined his relationship with his teammates by questioning his toughness. Several players anonymously told the Mercury News that Smith had been nicknamed the Lion, after the Cowardly Lion in The Wizard of Oz. "I always liked Mike. What went on with us wasn't personal," Smith said. "It may have felt personal at times, but we were both trying to do what was best for the team. He was fighting for his job, so he was frustrated. I was frustrated because my shoulder wasn't supposed to hurt as much as it did, but it hurt like hell. I'm willing to play through pain. That's part of football. But I didn't think I was doing anyone any good going out there and playing horribly because every time I tried to throw the ball, my shoulder was screaming at me in pain." On December 11th, Smith had surgery on his shoulder. But the damage to his relationship with Nolan was more difficult to repair. Nolan was going through a difficult season, too. A 2-0 start with playoff hopes had dissolved during an 8-game losing streak. His father, his hero, and his coaching mentor passed away on November 7th, 3 days after the team's 6th straight loss. 5 days later came the shutout loss in Seattle, followed by Smith being shut down. The 49ers finished 5-11. And Scott McLuhan was hired as general manager, taking away Nolan's control of player personnel decisions. Both Nolan and the quarterback he had chosen to be his franchise quarterback appeared to be on shaky ground heading into the 2008 season. Because the offense had been awful, with or without Smith, Hostler was fired. And for the 6th straight season, the 4th since Smith had been drafted, the 49ers began the season with a new coordinator. This time it was Mike Martz, the coach credited with creating the greatest show on turf offense that had helped the Rams win the Super Bowl in 2000 and return there 2 seasons later. March was a believer in the spread offense, one not that different from what Smith had run under Urban Meyer at Utah. Still, Smith found himself in a battle with Sean Hill and JT O'Sullivan, who had been in Detroit with Martz and knew the offense well, for the starting job during training camp. Making life more difficult was nagging pain in his surgical shoulder. O'Sullivan was selected as the opening day starter, and the 49ers lost to the Cardinals 23-13. Midway through the following week, the pain in Smith's shoulder was so bad he couldn't lift his arm above his head. Back he went to Dr. Andrews. This time, Andrews found a broken bone in the shoulder caused, he believed, by a wire inserted during the previous surgery that had somehow sawed through the bone. Smith was placed on injured reserve. His season was over before it started. On October 21st, with the team 2-5, Nolan was fired and replaced by Mike Singletary, the Hall of Fame linebacker. Hill became the quarterback. McLuhan told the media there was absolutely no way the 49ers could afford to pay Smith the $9.625 million he was due to be paid in 2009, the fifth year of the record-breaking six-year $49.5 million rookie contract he had signed in 2005. As he rehabbed from his surgery, Smith had no idea what was coming next in his career or his life. Ryan Fitzpatrick's rookie contract wasn't quite in the same neighborhood as Smith's. He was guaranteed $230,000, and with bonuses, that amount jumped to about $309,000 for that first season. Fitzpatrick was fine with it. He was also fine with wearing a baseball cap on the sidelines when the season began. He was the Rams' third-string quarterback, behind Mark Bulger and Jamie Martin. In October, Bulger hurt his shoulder and was replaced by Martin, Fitzpatrick becoming the backup. 3 weeks later, Bulger returned and was instantly hurt again. The following week, with the Rams playing in Houston, Martin went down, with the Texans leading 21-0 in the second quarter. Suddenly, Fitzpatrick was wearing a helmet instead of a baseball cap. "The good news was, I didn't really have time to think about it," he said years later with a laugh. "We lost the last two, and we were in deep water when I went in. I just tried to keep the ball moving downfield." He did so to the tune of 310 yards and three touchdowns, leading the Rams to a stunning come-from-behind 33-27 overtime victory. The Rams trailed 27-17 with under a minute to play before Fitzpatrick found Isaac Bruce for a 43-yard touchdown pass with 26 seconds left to make the score 27-24. The Rams then recovered an onside kick, and Fitzpatrick completed a 19-yard pass to John Smith with 4 seconds left. Jeff Wilkins kicked a 47-yard field goal to tie it. Then, in overtime, Fitzpatrick took the Rams 90 yards in 6 plays, the last one a 56-yard strike to Kevin Curtis to win the game. It was an extraordinary debut, especially for the 250th pick in the draft, who had been selected in large part because of his score, 48, on the Wonderlic test. "I had the advantage that week that the Texans had never seen me," Fitzpatrick said. "They had no idea what I did well or what I didn't do so well. NFL teams learn fast. A week later, the opponent had seen me on tape, and it was a different ball game." Indeed, it was. Having played so well in Houston, Fitzpatrick was rewarded with the start a week later at home against Washington. That made him the first Harvard quarterback to ever start an NFL game. Sadly, the results weren't the same. Washington won the game 24-9. A week later at Minnesota, Fitzpatrick threw 5 interceptions. The following week, after a poor first half against the Eagles, Martin replaced him for the second half. Fitzpatrick didn't know it at the time, but he wouldn't throw another pass for 3 years until the 2008 season. "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times," he said. To some extent, it was a time that might try a man's soul. But Fitzpatrick had proven he could play in the NFL. The Rams hired Scott Linehan to replace Mike Martz as coach for the 2006 season, and Bulger stayed healthy all season, starting 16 games. The team also brought in Gus Frerotte, the ex-Washington starter, as Bulger's backup, meaning that Fitzpatrick was once again the third stringer. Which is why, when he was traded to the Cincinnati Bengals on the eve of the 2008 season opener, he was happy to make the move. Carson Palmer was the Bengals quarterback, and he was one of the more durable QBs in the NFL. He'd needed major knee surgery in January 2006 after getting hit as he released a pass in a playoff game against the Steelers. The thinking was that it would be difficult for Palmer to rehab in time for the start of the season, but he was behind center for the opening exhibition game. The Bengals still needed a backup with some experience. The only other quarterback on their roster going into the season was rookie Jordan Palmer, so they traded a seventh-round draft pick to the Rams for a former seventh-round draft pick, Fitzpatrick. At the very least, Fitzpatrick was going to a team where he would be the backup, not a third stringer, even though Palmer's recent history indicated Fitzpatrick probably wouldn't see the field very often. It didn't work out that way. In the third game of the season, a loss to the New York Giants, Palmer felt a twinge in his elbow late in the game and had to come out. A week later, Fitzpatrick was the starter against Cleveland, which turned out to be the Bengals' fourth straight loss. Palmer returned to play against Dallas, but felt more pain in the elbow. It turned out he had partially torn a ligament and a tendon in his elbow. He was done for the season. Fitzpatrick started the last 11 games and went 4-6-1, which wasn't bad, given that the team had been 0-5 prior to that. The tie was against the Eagles. It was after that game that Philadelphia quarterback Donovan McNabb admitted he didn't know games could end in a five-quarter tie. He just assumed you kept playing until somebody scored. McNabb was pilloried for his honesty, and some in the media brought out the old black quarterback stereotypes. This was several years after Rush Limbaugh, during his brief and embarrassing stint on ESPN, claimed that the media was overrating McNabb because it wanted to see a black quarterback succeed. Limbaugh was fired soon after that, only after ESPN was attacked, not only for hiring Limbaugh, but for trying to sweep the McNabb comments under any rug it could find. Still, the ugly stereotype persisted. 3 years after the fifth quarter incident, McNabb, having been traded to Washington, was benched by coach Mike Shanahan late in a game against the Detroit Lions in favor of Rex Grossman. On his first snap, with Washington trailing 31-25, Grossman was sacked and fumbled. The ball was picked up by the Lions' Ndamukong Suh, who trotted 17 yards into the end zone. When Shanahan was asked about his decision to change quarterbacks in his postgame press conference, he said he wasn't sure if McNabb knew the team's two-minute offense. A simple, "Donovan hadn't had a great game, so I decided to give Rex a shot," would have sufficed. But Shanahan was one of those never-wrong coaches. A day later, when that explanation had failed to fly, Shanahan claimed he wasn't sure if McNabb was in shape to run back-to-back plays in the two-minute offense. To top it all off, Shanahan, or his son Kyle, the offensive coordinator, then leaked to ESPN's Chris Mortensen the fact that they had been forced to cut their playbook in half because McNabb couldn't learn the entire thing. They'd called McNabb dumb, out of shape, and then really dumb. Talk about stereotyping. To try to prove that the Shanahans weren't putting McNabb down, the team made a huge production of announcing a contract extension for McNabb, one that could be worth $88 million. What they didn't mention was that there was a clause in the deal that said he'd receive only the $3 million signing bonus, basically hush money, if he was cut after the season. McNabb kept his mouth shut and, surprise, was cut at season's end so that the Shanahans could go with Grossman and the immortal John Beck as their quarterbacks the following season. They went 5-11. Fitzpatrick knew the fifth quarter rule. Like McNabb, he also failed to get his team into the end zone. No one called him dumb. He was, after all, a Harvard graduate. And white. Fitzpatrick was a restricted free agent at the end of the 2008 season, and had some value as a backup who had proven he could be reasonably effective as a starter. The Buffalo Bills offered him a 3-year contract that was worth $7.5 million, a considerable step up from his rookie contract in 2005. He wasn't in Alex Smith territory, but he was making progress. Dick Geron, a Yale graduate, was entering his fourth season as the Bills' coach, the first coach to last that long since Marv Levy had retired at the end of the 1997 season. Trent Edwards was the starter, Fitzpatrick the backup. Except Edwards went down with a concussion in the sixth game of the season. In came Fitzpatrick, the patron saint quarterback of comebacks for bad teams. The Bills rallied to beat the Jets 16-13 in overtime. By now, there were starting to be jokes told in the locker room about the Fitzpatrick jinx. Everywhere he went as a backup, or so it seemed, The starter ended up getting hurt sooner or later, and there was Fitzpatrick leading the team. Years later, when Fitzpatrick signed with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers prior to the 2017 season, he joked that, quote, Jameis, Winston, has to be just a little bit nervous. Fitzpatrick started the next two games in 2009 for the Bills, and the team split them before Edwards returned after the bye week when the team played in Tennessee. That game didn't go well for anyone. The Bills lost 41-17, and 2 days later, Giron was fired. Interim coach Perry Fuel's first act was to name Fitzpatrick the starter. For once, Fitzpatrick got to take the opening snap because his coach thought he was the best option, not because of an injury. The Bills were 3-3 the rest of the way, and Fitzpatrick played solidly. Chan Gailey was hired as the new coach and decided to go with Edwards to start the season. But an 0-2 start changed his mind, and Fitzpatrick became the starter in Week 3 when the Bills played the Patriots. After a loss to the Packers 34-7, expectations were low, to say the least. But Fitzpatrick kept the team in the game until late in the fourth quarter before the Patriots prevailed 38-30. The next day, the Bills released Edwards. They signed Brian Brohm as Fitzpatrick's backup. For the first time in his career, Fitzpatrick was the unquestioned starter. Sadly, it was for a bad team. The Bills started 0-9, but managed to go 4-3 down the stretch, with Fitzpatrick playing solidly, if not spectacularly. People often forget that the number of NFL quarterbacks who play spectacularly is a lot smaller than those who are at best solid, at worst awful. That explains why Kirk Cousins, after leading Washington to a record of 24-24-1, including one playoff loss, in three seasons as the starter, was able to command the $72 million three-year guaranteed contract he received as a free agent in March 2018. No one believed for a second that Cousins was anywhere close to Tom Brady, Aaron Rodgers, Drew Brees, or a healthy Andrew Luck. In the NFL, especially at the quarterback position, it isn't about who's best, it's about who's next. Most teams need to try to improve at the position, and when someone with a proven track record of goodness becomes available, teams pounce. Greatness rarely comes on the free agent market. Goodness does. Fitzpatrick was good enough in 2010 that Gailey decided to stick with him the following season. The Bills' offseason mission was to shore up the defense. That's why their first four picks in the draft were defensive players. The 2011 season started wonderfully for Buffalo and Fitzpatrick. The Bills went to Kansas City and routed the Chiefs 41-7 in Week 1, then came from way behind the next 2 weeks, first beating the Oakland Raiders 38-35, and then coming from 18 points down to stun the Patriots 34-31. The win was the first for the Bills over New England since 2003, a streak of 15 straight losses. By then, Fitzpatrick had become something of a cult figure in Buffalo. He had grown a huge bushy beard, mostly to stay warm, and it had become his trademark. A lot of it was that I didn't much like shaving, he said. Fortunately, my wife liked it, so I just kept it. The Bills didn't really care about the beard one way or the other, but they liked what they were seeing on the field. And so, on October 28th, during the team's bye week, they announced that they had signed Fitzpatrick to a new deal that was for 6 years and could be worth $59 million. There was a $10 million signing bonus, and the guaranteed money was about $18 million, ensuring Fitzpatrick a total of $28 million. NFL contracts are almost never guaranteed for their announced value. Even for a Harvard graduate, that was pretty good money a month shy of his 29th birthday. It was all good right about then, Fitzpatrick said. We liked Buffalo. The people were incredibly nice, and I got used to the cold, sort of, after a while. Best thing, though, was Chan had given me the chance to start, and we were playing really well as a team. The good times, however, didn't last. 2 days after the Bills announced Fitzpatrick's new contract, the team played Washington in Toronto, the game being part of the Toronto series that had started in 2009. Because of flagging attendance, Buffalo played one game annually in the Rogers Center, the stadium with the retractable roof that housed the Toronto Blue Jays during baseball season. The game proved to be the last high point of the season. The Bills won easily 23-0 to up their record to 5-2, putting them in position, or so it appeared, to make the playoffs for the first time since 1999. But it was downhill from there, starting that afternoon. On a rare positive play for Washington, linebacker London Fletcher sacked Fitzpatrick, who felt pain go through him. It turned out he had broken two ribs. It didn't keep him from playing. In fact, he never even appeared on a weekly injury report. But it made playing and throwing difficult. He wasn't the same player the last nine games of the season, and the Bills weren't the same team. The problems went well beyond Fitzpatrick's ribs. Star running back Fred Jackson, two starting wide receivers, and linebacker Sean Merriman all went down for the season with various injuries. Lacking weapons, with a quarterback playing hurt and a defense missing key players, the Bills faded badly. They lost seven straight games before beating the Broncos in the penultimate week of the season. By then, it didn't matter. The victory made them 6-9. A week later, the Patriots blew them out 49-21, and the season ended with a thud. Thinking they were close to being a playoff team, the Bills signed defensive end Mario Williams to the largest free agent contract in team history, $100 million with $50 million guaranteed. But they began the 2012 season with back-to-back losses and never really recovered. They were 5-7 and still on the fringes of playoff contention going into December before a three-game losing streak doomed them again. By the time they beat the Jets to close out the season, they were 6-10 again. Fitzpatrick had a solid year statistically, throwing 24 touchdown passes and 16 interceptions. He threw for a career-high 3,400 yards. It just wasn't good enough. Gailey, the coach who had put so much faith in him, was fired at season's end. He was replaced by Doug Marrone, and the Bills asked Fitzpatrick to take a pay cut, thinking they were going to draft a young quarterback and let Fitzpatrick keep the seat warm until he was ready to play. Fitzpatrick didn't like the idea of taking a pay cut, especially since the team's failures had little to do with him. In March, when the new NFL season officially started, Fitzpatrick was cut. A little more than a month later, the Bills used their first-round pick on quarterback E.J. Manuel. Fitzpatrick was 30 and had been in the league for eight seasons, eight more than most people would have guessed. He'd played for four teams and had been a starter in 68 games. Now, 17 months after signing his dream contract, he was out of work. "Goes with the territory," he said. "When things go well, everyone loves you. When they don't, people fall out of love. In a hurry." 6. Andrew Luck never had much trouble getting people to love him, especially when he was playing football. Luck was the oldest of Oliver and Kathy Luck's four children, born almost 3 years after his father had retired, having played five seasons as an NFL quarterback. Oliver Luck had started at West Virginia and had been drafted in the second round of the 1982 draft, 44th pick, by the Houston Oilers. He was the third quarterback taken that spring behind the ill-fated Art Schliester, fourth, and future Super Bowl winner Jim McMahon, fifth. Luck spent most of his pro career backing up Hall of Fame quarterbacks, two seasons with Archie Manning and three with Warren Moon. He did start for about half the 1983 season when Manning was hurt. If nothing else, Luck and Manning had to be the first teammates to father quarterbacks who became the number one pick as quarterbacks in the NFL draft. Manning had two, Peyton in 1998 and Eli in 2004. Luck had Andrew in 2012. When his playing career was over, Luck, who had graduated from West Virginia magnum cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa, went to law school at the University of Texas. It was there that he met Kathy. Both left with law degrees, and soon after, Andrew was born in September 1989. A year later, Luck ran for Congress in West Virginia, taking on three-term Democrat Harley O. Staggers, Jr. in the general election. He lost a tight race and decided to give up politics for sports. Within a year, he and his growing family were living overseas. Oliver took a job in Germany as general manager of the NFL-run World League of American Football's Rhein-Fire. A year later, he took over the Frankfurt Galaxy, and 2 years after that was named as the league's president. By then, the NFL, in an attempt to keep the product alive, was calling it NFL Europe as a marketing ploy to make sure people knew that the league was connected to the all-powerful NFL. In essence, it was football AAA. Players who couldn't make an NFL roster went to NFL Europe to keep their careers alive and hope they would get another chance to catch on with an NFL team. Growing up in Europe until the age of 11, Andrew was a soccer fan first and foremost and remains one to this day. It wasn't until his family moved to Houston and his dad was hired as CEO of the Houston Sports Authority that he became involved in traditional American sports. "I knew about football when we were living in Europe. My dad was running a football league," he said. "I knew he'd been a quarterback in the NFL, so someday being a quarterback was in my mind for sure. Back then, I sort of thought every kid's dad played in the NFL. It wasn't until I was older that I realized how unusual that was. But I really enjoyed soccer when I was young. That's what we played at recess in school, and again, I just figured that's the way it was everywhere. It wasn't until we moved to Houston that I found out different. Even then, I never lost my passion for soccer. I still follow it closely." Andrew was always one of the biggest kids in his class, which is why when he first played Pop Warner football, he played defensive end and occasionally running back. When he got to the seventh grade, a coach named Rick Thornton decided that his height and his arm merited a chance to play quarterback. From that day forward, quarterback was his position. He continued to play all sports through high school. He played basketball for 4 years and was a 2-year starter. "I was a rebounder, a defender, and a fouler," he said with a laugh. "I couldn't shoot." He also played baseball and ran track. The 300 hurdles and the 4x400 relay were his specialties. By the time he was a high school senior, he was 6'4", weighed 225 pounds, and had excellent grades and board scores. He picked Stanford over dozens of big-time schools dying to recruit him, in part because of the academics, in part because of the campus, but also because the coach, Jim Harbaugh, had played in the NFL for 14 seasons and ran a pro-style offense. "Stanford had everything I wanted," he said. "I figured it was hard to go wrong there." He was right. After redshirting as a freshman, he became the starter in 2009. By then, Harbaugh had recruited very good players, and the Cardinal had their first winning season since 2001, a span that included two fired coaches and a 1-11 record the year before Harbaugh arrived. The 8-5 record included a bid to the Sun Bowl and a 55-21 upset of USC in Los Angeles. The Trojans weren't quite the superpower they had been a few years earlier, but they were still ranked 11th in the national polls, and Stanford's win, 3 years removed from being 1-11, got national attention. Luck didn't play in the Sun Bowl after breaking a finger on his throwing hand in the regular season finale against Notre Dame, a 45-38 win. Even so, he had emerged as a star. He was everything an NFL team was looking for in a quarterback. Big, strong-armed, smart, and with experience running a pro-style offense, which would mean he wouldn't go through an adjustment period the way, for example, Alex Smith had coming out of college after running a spread offense. A year later, Stanford, most notably Harbaugh and Luck, exploded into the national consciousness. The Cardinal went 12-1, the only loss coming at Oregon. Autzen Stadium in Eugene has always been one of the toughest places in the country to play because the stands are so close to the playing field. It becomes even more difficult when the Ducks are good. The 2010 Oregon team under Chip Kelly wasn't just good, it was great. Oregon would go 12-0 in the regular season before losing the national championship game to Auburn 22-19 on a field goal as time ran out. That game was the second all season in which Oregon failed to score at least 35 points. Stanford lost at Autzen 52-31 because their defense, like all the others Oregon faced in the Pac-10, couldn't stop Kelly's spread offense. The Cardinal went to the Orange Bowl as a consolation prize and crushed ACC champion Virginia Tech 40-12. Luck finished second in the Heisman Trophy voting behind Auburn's Cam Newton. The only thing that might have denied Newton the trophy that season was the NCAA investigation into whether his father had, for all intents and purposes, sold his son to the highest bidder while he was in junior college. The last thing the NCAA wanted to do was take the star quarterback of the number one ranked team in the country off the field. So it came up with a unique out for Newton. It found that if the student athlete, was unaware that someone else was breaking rules on his behalf, he would not be punished. As a result, Newton skated, played in the national title game, and won the Heisman. Luck was eligible for the draft after his sophomore season, since he had redshirted as a freshman, and players are allowed into the draft 3 years after their high school class graduates. But he decided to stay at Stanford to get his degree, and because the Cardinal had a chance to be a top-five team again in 2011. Most of the key players from the team that had finished ranked number four after the Orange Bowl win were returning. "We had some really, really good players," Luck said. "We had guys with NFL talent. We had a great offensive line. I was in the fortunate position that I didn't need the money. My family was doing just fine. So I had the option to stay in college. I loved college, so I decided to stay." He made the decision even though Harbaugh had left to take the job as coach of the San Francisco 49ers. Luck was very comfortable with David Shaw, who had been the offensive coordinator, and was promoted to take Harbaugh's place. "Coach Shaw was definitely different than Coach Harbaugh," Luck said. "He could be fiery at times, but he was more inclusive. He wanted the seniors to kind of take charge of the team, make it their team." Even though Luck was a junior in terms of eligibility, he was a senior academically and clearly the team's leader as the quarterback, not to mention the runner-up for the Heisman Trophy. Luck's last season went exactly as he had hoped, almost. Again, Oregon was the kryptonite in Stanford's national championship dreams. This time the Ducks came to Stanford and turned it into Autzen Stadium on the second Saturday in November. The score was almost the same as it had been a year earlier, 53-30. Because Stanford and Oregon were both in the newly formed Pac-12 North, the league had gone to divisions when it had expanded that season after Colorado and Utah joined, and each finished 7-1. Stanford didn't get to play in the conference title game since Oregon had the head-to-head tiebreaker. Instead, Stanford went to the Fiesta Bowl, where it played third-ranked Oklahoma State and lost 41-38 in a shootout. Even though Luck played well, he was 27 of 31 passing for 347 yards and 2 touchdowns, it was a deflating end to his college career. The first week in December, he had again finished second in the Heisman voting, this time losing out to Baylor's spectacular Robert Griffin III. Griffin received 405 first-place votes to Luck's 247. Both were considered great pro prospects, although Luck was clearly number one in the minds of NFL scouts. He was considered such a lock to be the number one pick during the fall of 2011, the NFL's worst teams unofficially engaged what was labeled the Suck for Luck campaign. The Indianapolis Colts, 2-14, outsucked the St. Louis Rams, 2-14, and the Minnesota Vikings, 3-13, to get the number one pick. The Colts won the tiebreaker with the Rams based on the Rams having had a more difficult schedule. The Colts had been in the playoffs for 9 straight seasons prior to 2011, but when Peyton Manning had neck surgery and had to sit out the season, the Colts went into the tank completely, losing their first 13 games. 2 late wins made Indy fans nervous, but the team finished with a 19-13 loss in Jacksonville to wrap up the Suck title. To this day, one of football's more intriguing questions is, who did Andrew Luck succeed as Colts quarterback? The answer is not Manning. It is, in fact, Dan Orlovsky, who took over midway through the season for Curtis Painter, who had been Manning's backup prior to the future Hall of Famer's injury. Luck laughs at the question. "See, there's no pressure on me at all," he said. "No knock on Dan, but it's not as if I succeeded Peyton Manning." Except, in reality, he did just that. The Colts released Manning on March 7th, the official start of the 2012 NFL season. Manning had been the Colts for most of 14 seasons, but that didn't matter in NFL world. Sentiment leads to losing. Manning was about to be 36 and was coming off major surgery. The future was the 22-year-old phenom from Stanford. "I guess it happens to everyone at some point, doesn't it?" Luck said one evening in the spring of 2017. "I'm 27, and I'm already starting to feel old around the rookies on the team. It goes quickly." Luck was picked number one, and Griffin was picked number two by Washington, which traded a slew of draft picks to the Rams to move up in order to take Griffin. Both were instantly tabbed as the future, actually the present, of their franchises. The moment they got their hug from Roger Goodell, the NFL's hug-obsessed commissioner, they were the faces of their new teams, which is a fact of life for those who play quarterback in the NFL. especially when they are drafted to be starters right away. That was the case with Luck and with Griffin. Welcome. We love you. Now win, or else. The case can be made that no quarterback in NFL history has fallen farther or faster than Robert Griffin III, after he had an astounding trip to one of the highest pedestals ever reached by a rookie quarterback. Griffin was a hero in Washington even before he took a snap. The trade for Donovan McNabb in 2010 had turned into a disaster when he ran afoul of the Shanahans, Father Mike, Son Kyle. Then came the ill-fated John Beck, Rex Grossman 2011 season, which ended with Washington going 4-12. That left the team with the number 6 pick in the draft. It wasn't going to be high enough to get either Luck or Griffin. There was no way the Colts were giving up the number 1 pick. But the Rams, who believed they had their quarterback in Sam Bradford, the number 1 pick in the 2010 draft, were willing to listen. The Rams ended up acquiring Washington's top pick, the 6th in the draft, Washington's number 1 picks for 2013 and 2014, and a second-round pick in the 2012 draft in return for the number 2 overall pick in that year's draft. In NFL terms, this was a king's ransom. Most general managers would rather part with their firstborn child than give up a number 1 pick, much less 2 in back-to-back years. Washington knew that Luck was going to Indianapolis with the first pick, and the reason for the trade was to get the chance to draft Griffin. Griffin appeared to be everything an NFL team could possibly want. In addition to his remarkable physical skills, he was the son of a military veteran, was articulate, had a great smile, and came off as completely charming in the media. The stereotypes still sometimes attached to African-American quarterbacks couldn't be put on him. He had graduated from Baylor in 3 years with a 3.67 GPA and had started working toward a master's degree. He wasn't just smart, he was smart. After taking Griffin right behind Luck, Shanahan drafted a second quarterback, Michigan State's Kirk Cousins, in the 4th round. The pick was little noticed. Shanahan, having spent a miserable 2011 without an NFL-quality quarterback, wanted a viable backup for Griffin and thought Cousins could be that guy. For 1 year, the Griffin trade looked like a steal for Washington. If the team had given up 5 number ones, the trade would have been the right choice, because Griffin appeared to be exactly what every NFL team dreams of finding, a generational quarterback, a Brady, a Rodgers, a Breeze. Griffin wasn't good. He was great. In Washington's opener at New Orleans, arguably the league's loudest stadium, he completed 19 of 26 passes for 320 yards and 2 touchdowns. He also ran for 42 yards on 10 carries, and led his team to a stunning 40-32 win over Breeze and the Saints. Griffin was close to perfect on and off the field. He stuck around to high-five the small group of celebrating Washington fans, then said all the right things, crediting the coaches and his teammates. He couldn't possibly be that good every week, and the otherwise mediocre Washington team slumped to 3-6. Then Griffin got on a roll, making remarkable plays at critical times the next 7 weeks. Washington won 3 straight against the NFC East, routing the Eagles, beating the Cowboys in Dallas on Thanksgiving behind another remarkable Griffin performance, and then beating the Giants 17-16 when Griffin hit Pierre Garçon with an 8-yard touchdown pass to cap a 4th-quarter drive. A week later, trailing the Baltimore Ravens by 8 in the 4th quarter, Griffin scrambled. He was hit by the Ravens' huge defensive tackle, Haloti Ngata, and pain shot through his right knee. It was the same knee he'd had surgery on as a Baylor sophomore. He hobbled off the field, but came back after missing just 1 play. After the game, Shanahan would claim that team doctor James Andrews, the renowned orthopedic surgeon, had told him it was okay to send Griffin back in, that the knee was fine. Later, Andrews would say he had no such conversation with Shanahan, that, in fact, Griffin avoided him on the sideline, circled back to the coaches, and went back into the game. "I never had a chance to look at him," Andrews said. This was the beginning of a lengthy he-said-he-said that would consume the franchise for the next 3 years. Griffin went back in for 4 more plays, clearly hobbled, before being relieved again by Kirk Cousins. In what would prove to be a harbinger, Cousins got Washington into the end zone, hit on the 2-point conversion, and led the team to an overtime win. Griffin's injury was diagnosed as a sprained LCL. He sat out the next week in Cleveland, and Cousins led the team to a 38-21 win. If nothing else, he had proven that Shanahan knew what he was doing when he used that fourth-round pick on him in the spring. Griffin came back for the last two games of the regular season, a win in Philadelphia and a Sunday night victory over the Cowboys in the finale that clinched the NFC East. For Washington, a town obsessed with the Cowboys, a quarterback who swept Dallas as a rookie, including a division-clinching win as a climax to the season, was just about ready for a statue. Not only was Washington in the playoffs, it got to play at home against Seattle in the first round. As it turned out, that evening, January 6, 2013, was the beginning of the end for Griffin and for Mike Shanahan in Washington. Griffin was almost perfect in the first quarter, and his team jumped to a 14-0 lead. But scrambling to try to pick up a first down deep in Seattle territory, Griffin stumbled and fell on the sideline and didn't get up. He came out only briefly, but when he returned, he was clearly limping. It didn't help that the turf inside Washington's home stadium is generally considered the worst in the NFL. The team has been unable to find a way to improve the quality of the field to this day, and playing an injured Griffin on that field was insane. Once again, there were questions about what Andrews had said or not said to Shanahan about Griffin's condition. But it didn't take one of the world's great orthopedic surgeons to see that Griffin was hurting and didn't belong on a bad field against a ferocious defense. By the fourth quarter, the Seahawks had taken a 24-14 lead. With Griffin clearly not himself, Washington failed to score after its first two drives. On a third down and long, Griffin in a shotgun reached for a snap that was low and wide. He couldn't corral it, and as he went to try to pick it up, his knee buckled. He couldn't get up. This time, he didn't return. As it turned out, he had torn the LCL and the ACL joints. He needed surgery. The blame game began. Griffin was never the same player. He insisted he would be back for the start of training camp, then complained publicly when Shanahan kept him out of the preseason lineup. Burned once, Shanahan wasn't going to rush him back. Griffin publicly criticized Shanahan for not playing him. By then, it was clear that Shanahan and Griffin's relationship was awful, and that Griffin, because he knew he had Snyder's backing, felt no obligation to pretend publicly that he and his coach were on the same page. After he was fired, Shanahan talked publicly about a meeting he and Griffin had a month after the Seattle game in which, according to Shanahan, Griffin more or less laid down ground rules. He wanted to be a pocket passer to stay away from injuries. He didn't want to run the read option offense that had helped make him a star as a rookie. Shanahan remembered Griffin telling him which play calls were acceptable and which ones were unacceptable. "I realized that was Dan, Snyder, talking," Shanahan said. Unacceptable was one of his words. He frequently said things were unacceptable. Without taking a preseason snap, Griffin started game one, a 33-27 loss to the Eagles. It went downhill quickly from there. Losing in Green Bay the next week was no surprise, but then the Lions came to town and walked away with a 27-20 victory to drop Washington to 0-3. It was the first time in history that Detroit had won in any D.C. area stadium. Griffin wasn't the same quarterback he'd been as a rookie. He ran less often, and when he did run, some of his speed and elusiveness weren't there in the wake of major reconstructive knee surgery. When Washington dropped to 3-10 after an embarrassing 45-10 loss to the Kansas City Chiefs, Shanahan announced that Griffin would sit out the final three games of the season in order to prevent further injury. Cousins started the last three games, and Washington went 1-2. Shanahan and son Kyle were both fired the day after the season ended. Snyder wanted a coach who would do what he was told, especially when it came to Griffin. In came Jay Gruden. Remarkably, things got worse in Gruden's first season. Griffin dislocated an ankle in week two, and Cousins became the starter. 4 weeks later, he was benched in favor of third-stringer Colt McCoy. Somehow, McCoy led Washington to an overtime win in Dallas and, as always happens when a new guy succeeds, became a hero in Washington. Griffin and Cousins became yesterday's news. Griffin's rookie year might as well have been 200 years earlier, not 2 years earlier. McCoy had star quality that Cousins lacked. He had finished second in the Heisman Trophy voting as a junior at Texas and third as a senior, while leading Texas to a 12-0 record and a spot against Alabama in the national title game. He'd been injured in that game and apparently due to his lack of height, 6'1", hadn't been drafted until the Cleveland Browns took him in the third round. He started for a season and a half for the Browns and was traded to the 49ers after 3 years. He threw one pass for San Francisco in 2013 and then signed with Washington for the 2014 season, presumably to back up Griffin and Cousins. A week after the Dallas game, Griffin was healthy and, apparently at Snyder's insistence, was the starter against the Vikings. Both teams were 3-5 and hoping to sneak into playoff contention. Griffin didn't play poorly, 18 of 28 for one touchdown and one interception, but Vikings rookie Teddy Bridgewater rallied his team to a 29-26 victory. A week later, Washington went down meekly at home, losing 27-7 to Tampa Bay, while the crowd spent most of the second half chanting, "We want Colt." Griffin had gone from the hero in town to someone most couldn't wait to see leave, including his coach. When Griffin suffered a concussion in the second exhibition game of 2015, it turned out to be his last hurrah in Washington. With the uncertainty of when Griffin would return as an excuse, Gruden announced that Cousins would start the opener and would be Washington's quarterback for 2015. "He's been our best quarterback and he deserves to start," Gruden said. Griffin never saw the field, except from the sidelines all season, and was never once activated for a game. Cousins had a good year, not a great year, but good enough to allow Washington to win a weak NFC East with a 9-7 record. He became the town's darling. Cousins was everything an NFL fan base can love. He was handsome, always said the right things, had a growing family, talked about his Christianity, and was healthy. It isn't as if NFL fans won't accept an African-American quarterback. They will, as long as he's great. When Griffin got married between his first and second seasons in Washington, before the fall from grace, fans sent him hundreds of wedding gifts, as if he needed them. Those gifts provided a first small clue that perhaps Griffin wasn't quite as smart as he was articulate. Instead of tweeting a thank you to all his adoring fans and saying he was going to make a donation to charity in honor of all of them, he tweeted photos of himself with some of the gifts. No one minded then. Griffin left Washington quietly in 2016, released on March 7th. 17 days later, the Cleveland Browns signed him. Given that no franchise in football history had ever been in more desperate need of a legitimate NFL quarterback, there really was no gamble for Cleveland in the move. Coach Hugh Jackson even made Griffin the starter for the season opener. Naturally, he hurt his shoulder in the opener and missed the next 12 weeks. He came back to start the final 4 weeks of the season and played well enough to lead the Browns to a 2017 win over San Diego on Christmas Eve, their lone win of the season. Merry Christmas. On the first official day of the 2017 season, March 10th, the Browns released Griffin. He sat out the entire season before the Baltimore Ravens signed him to a last-chance, no-risk contract to back up Joe Flacco. Then they drafted Louisville Heisman Trophy winner Lamar Jackson, leaving Griffin in third-string limbo going into training camp in 2018. 7. Here's the thing about playing quarterback in the NFL. There are only a handful that are good enough to make you better. There are quite a few who are good enough to allow you to win if you have a good team. And then there are some who play because, well, you can't line up without someone to snap the ball to, right? Doug Williams was relaxed, eating a light dinner, soup and salad, at one of his favorite restaurants, Eddie Merlot's, an upscale steakhouse about 5 minutes from Washington's team headquarters in Ashburn, Virginia. Williams was talking both as a Super Bowl-winning quarterback and as an NFL player personnel director about the uncertain life of an NFL quarterback. It was November 2017, and Washington had just traveled to Seattle and stunned the Seahawks 17-14, driving 70 yards in 35 seconds in the final minute for the winning touchdown. When they, the Seahawks, scored to go ahead with 1:34 left, "I got up to go downstairs," Williams said with a laugh. "I was waiting by the elevator and saw him complete the first pass. I figured I'd better wait." him was Kirk Cousins, Washington's quarterback and the only man in Washington who could compete with Donald Trump when it came to controversy. The first pass had been a 31-yard completion to Brian Quick that had moved the ball to Seattle's 39-yard line. A moment later, Cousins threw a ball down the sideline in the direction of Josh Doctson, and Doctson used every inch of his 6'2" frame to dive and catch the ball on the 1-yard line. One play later, Robert Kelly barreled into the end zone for the winning score. Four plays, 70 yards, two big pass plays to set up an unlikely win in a place where the best teams almost never won, much less the middle-of-the-road team from Washington. But they'd gone into Seattle with a banged-up offensive line and somehow won. Most of the screaming media in D.C. didn't pay much attention to Seattle's 16 penalties or three missed field goals. This was a miracle, and the hero was Cousins. If there had been a mayoral election in Washington that day, Cousins would have won by acclamation. He also could have been county executive in any surrounding suburb, a congressman from Maryland or Virginia, or if he preferred, a senator from either state, which realistically presented a potential problem for Williams. "We're 4-4, he said. "What's our record since Kirk's been the quarterback? I think it's 21-19. We've made the playoffs once. Haven't won a playoff game. We aren't likely to win the division this year." Philadelphia was 7-1 and had already beaten Washington twice. "Kirk has done some very good things. But when it's all said and done, he's been a 500 quarterback. If he wanted to sign a long-term deal, would we have to give it some serious thought? Yes, because there are a lot of teams with quarterbacks a lot less good than Kirk. We can do worse. The question is, can we do better?" Deep down, Williams knew the entire to sign or not to sign, the NFL version of Hamlet's dilemma, was really a moot point. There was too much bad blood between Cousins and the two men who had final say in matters like this, owner Dan Snyder and his henchman Bruce Allen. They'd had a chance to sign Cousins to a long-term contract, notably after the 2015 season when he'd taken the team to the playoffs. But in spite of the pleadings of then-general manager Scott McLuhan, they'd made him a low-ball offer and been forced to place a franchise tag on him for the 2016 season, requiring them to pay him $19.9 million. A year later, after a similar non-mating dance, Cousins had been franchised again, this time for $23.9 million. That meant the team had paid him $43.8 million for two seasons, when it probably could have signed him at the end of 2015 for about $45 million in guaranteed money for five seasons. Now the only way to guarantee that he played in Washington in 2018 would be to make him the first player ever to be franchise tagged for three straight seasons. The cost would be $34.6 million. And then a year after that, Cousins would be a free agent, and nothing, no amount of money, begging, pleading, or cajoling would keep him in town for 2019. Williams knew that. He also knew that even though the politically savvy Cousins was saying all the right things publicly about hoping his future was in Washington, he would be out of Dodge the first chance he got. Why stay with a team whose president, Allen, repeatedly calls you Kurt in public as if to imply that you aren't all that important? That was why Williams was looking at quarterbacks constantly on the pro level and on the college level. He'd made a point of seeing the ballyhooed college quarterbacks, Sam Darnold of USC, Josh Rosen of UCLA, Josh Allen of Wyoming, Baker Mayfield of Oklahoma, and Lamar Jackson of Louisville, in person and on tape. He wasn't necessarily sold on any one of them as the guy to get, and he knew that Washington's mediocrity, as opposed to being awful, meant it was unlikely that any of them would fall far enough in the draft to reach Washington. There would be no massive trade to move up either, not after the way the Griffin trade had ultimately worked out. He was intrigued by Alex Smith, who had 1 year left on his contract in Kansas City. That meant the only way to get Smith would be through a trade. There was, however, a good chance that Smith could be had for a reasonable price because the Chiefs had drafted Patrick Mahomes as his presumed heir in the previous spring's draft. "When Andy Reid called to tell me they were going to take a quarterback, I wasn't shocked," Smith had said during the summer. They hadn't made any sort of real change in the quarterback room in the 4 years since I'd gotten there. I understood. I knew the job was still mine for this season, 2017, but after that, all bets are off. You don't take someone at quarterback in the first round with the idea that he's going to sit and watch for 2 years. 1 year maybe, but not two. Williams knew that just as well as Smith did, which was why he was keeping a close eye on Smith as the season progressed. He knew Smith was a young 33, still quick and agile enough to run the occasional read option play, and much better equipped than Cousins to avoid a rush and keep a play alive without forcing a pass into coverage. There was also the advantage of knowing Smith would look at Washington as a fresh start if a deal could be made to bring him there. Cousins wanted out. Smith would be glad to walk in and take his place. In the back of his mind, Smith knew he was in his final year in Kansas City. He didn't want to think it, but after 13 seasons as a pro, he was a realist, which is why he wanted so much to make the most of what he expected was his last year playing for Andy Reid. He'd been part of one Super Bowl back in 2013 when he'd watched the 49ers play the Ravens from the sideline. He very much wanted his own Super Bowl team. He knew this might be as good a chance as he would get. Smith's journey to Kansas City had started the way a lot of player movement starts, with an injury. After Mike Nolan's firing, the 49ers went 5-4 the rest of the 2008 season, and Mike Singletary had the interim tag removed from his title. Singletary hired Jimmy Ray, who had once competed with Doug Williams for playing time in Tampa Bay, as his offensive coordinator. That made Smith 5-5. 5 seasons in the NFL, 5 offensive coordinators. Singletary interviewed 8 coaches before hiring Ray, a sign of how uncertain he felt about what was best for the team offensively. While Smith was rehabbing from his second shoulder surgery, general manager Scott McLuhan had told the media the 49ers intended to cut him at season's end. Smith had 2 seasons left on his contract and was due $24.6 million, including $9.6 million in 2009. The 49ers weren't willing to pay him that much money. Understanding that his free agent options would be limited coming off a lost season, Smith renegotiated with the 49ers, signing a new 2-year deal for $4 million annually, slightly higher than the going rate for veteran backup quarterbacks. Sean Hill had played well late in the season, and Singletary and Ray had penciled him in as the starter. The 49ers started 3-1, mostly on the strength of an improved defense. Not surprising, since Singletary had been a Hall of Fame linebacker in Chicago and had always coached on the defensive side of the ball. In week 4, the 49ers got blown out 45-10 in Atlanta, and then coming off their bye, trailed the Texans 21-0 in Houston when Singletary and Ray decided to see if Smith could do any better than Hill. He did, throwing 3 touchdown passes to Vernon Davis. The Texans won on a late field goal, but Smith had his job back. The following week in Indianapolis, he got his first start in almost 2 years. The 49ers lost 18-14 to drop to 3-4, but Smith played well enough to keep the starting job. Things didn't go especially well for the team the rest of the season. Singletary was a Nolan disciple and a friend. He had a temper, but was also a self-described Christian who often made it clear to the players that he expected them to go to church or team chapel services. "I was never comfortable with that," Smith said. "I always thought that religion is personal and that no one should tell you what's right and wrong for you. I would never presume to tell anyone else what to do." Mike brought it up all the time. There was an unspoken pressure to let Mike feel as if you were listening to him on the subject of religion. It was uncomfortable. The 49ers finished 8-8, winning their last 2 games after being eliminated from playoff contention. Smith had his best season statistically, and in an upset, Ray was retained as offensive coordinator. It meant for the first time in his career that Smith would spend an offseason with a coordinator he was familiar with. The experience didn't last long. The 49ers started 0-5, and with his support inside the team collapsing, Singletary fired Ray and promoted Mike Johnson to coordinator. Johnson opted to run a spread offense similar to what Smith had run in college. Things got no better for the team or for Smith. He was now getting booed regularly by 49er fans since, after all, it's always the quarterback who is to blame when a team goes south. The 49ers did win in Johnson's debut in his new job, beating the Raiders 17-9, with Smith throwing 2 touchdown passes. A week later, in a loss at Carolina, Smith hurt his throwing shoulder and had to come out. Troy Smith started the next 3 games, the first 2 victories, before Alex Smith was reinstated as the starter after a loss in Green Bay. By then, the team was in complete chaos. Singletary was fired with one game left in a 6-10 season. His parting words going out the door were, "You gotta have a quarterback." By now, Smith was considered a top pick blunder by almost everyone in football. He'd been in the league for 6 seasons, and his record as a starter was 19-51. The fact that much of that